So please continue eating. I'm just going to speak for a few minutes and ask if you, afterwards, you have any questions, you might want to address them. And we can discuss. After about 40 minutes or so, we're going to be doing a little chanting. And anyone who wants to stay for that, you can participate or watch, as the case may be. So this particular diet that we're involved in here is actually not something we invented, but it's a very ancient and tested system of not only eating, but also preparing foodstuffs from natural ingredients, dairy products, fruits, vegetables, and grains. And from these four essential elements, the whole range of Vedic food preparation becomes manifest. And it's very detailed. It's actually considered the oldest and most sophisticated form of food preparation. Generally, people think of French or Chinese or Indian food as being very advanced and having very many different complex arrangements. So this is actually true, but of the three, the ancient Vedic way of preparing food, particularly this called prasadam, is not only the most advanced in terms of nutrition, in terms of taste, but also it has a spiritual effect, spiritual potency. That's why it's called prasadam. That's the spiritual aspect that you don't ordinarily come across. So the principle in bhakti yoga is that if what we eat is offered with certain prayers of devotion to Krishna, we utter certain Sanskrit prayers, they're infused with spiritual potency. And this is called an offering. This is a tradition in many great religions and even spiritual practices that aren't necessarily religions per se, that offerings are made and mantras are recited. And just like we see in the tradition of Christianity, offerings were made to the Christ child, offerings and gifts, with the idea of a benefit or a blessing coming back. So similarly, these foodstuffs are offered to God or Krishna, and probably the difference between these offerings and our ordinary, what we're ordinarily familiar with, the, say the Judeo-Christian tradition, is that they're not being offered so much to gain a favor, but rather to please God, to please God himself. It's a little bit different. So there's a relationship that one develops with Krishna, which is not necessarily as the Father, but as sometimes even the son or the child. This is one of the ways in which Krishna manifests himself. Actually, he was born, or he took birth, I should say, as the son of a great devotee. The devotee was so advanced in Krishna consciousness that God himself took birth in the womb of this great devotee. So, in order to make himself more accessible, Krishna sometimes does this. Therefore, he comes in a very small form on which one can lavish parental affection. Of course, there are many, many different forms in which Krishna comes, not always as a child or the father. He also comes as the friend, a very dear friend. He comes as a lover. He comes in many different forms. He comes as an object of worship also. So these are the principal forms in which God manifests himself or incarnates. But there are many, many others, actually thousands, in fact, millions of different forms. One of the most important forms is this type of foodstuff. It is actually a type of incarnation. We've heard of different incarnations of God, great saints and prophets coming into the world, or Jesus Christ as the Son of God. So God comes in many, many forms. Sometimes he comes in disguise. 500 years ago, he came as Lord Chaitanya, which was a kind of disguised form. He didn't ever declare himself to be God, or even an incarnation of God, but he took the role of a devotee, and he played the part of the ideal devotee. He was always worshiping God, always praying to God, always singing the glories of God, always offering food to God, always reciting beautiful poetry, scriptures, and arguing the Vedic philosophy, even against many great scholars of his time. So in his lifetime, which took place in the 16th century, we're given the sort of the ideal life of a devotee, what an ideal devotee acts like. But according to the esoteric understanding of the Vedic literature, he was actually a very powerful incarnation, even more than an incarnation, but a full manifestation of personification of God. Anyway, this is Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, that's his name. We'll be celebrating his 500th centenary of his appearance in 1986. And one of the principles which he expostulated rather extensively was the nature of this spiritual food, or prasadam. There were many, many particular varieties which he listed in some of his writings, or writings that were written about him, and they were described in great detail. Not only what the ingredients were, but how they were prepared, how they were honored, how they were eaten, and how whole festivals were arranged around them. In fact, in certain temples in India, we find that the inhabitants of the region have become very expert in preparing a particular type of foodstuff that they offer to the deity. And the deity actually becomes known for that particular type of foodstuff. So, also there's a very wonderful temple in India, in the eastern province of Orissa, called Jagannath Temple, at which 40 different offerings, very elaborate, very huge offerings, many different varieties, are made before the deity 40 times every day. And anyone who goes and visits there gets big plates full of this prasadam. You actually find this all over India, that there are thousands and actually hundreds of thousands of Krishna temples where this prasadam is offered and then distributed. The principle is that people bring the raw ingredients in the form of vegetables, fruits, dairy products, and grains to the temple, and they are then transformed into spiritual foodstuffs offered to the deity and then distributed to the public at large. So actually this same principle is going on not only in India but in our temples all over the world. In fact, even in America we're getting, for some of our free food programs where we distribute to the poor, government food, surplus food from the government. They supply butter and certain other commodities like that. So in one sense you could say this ancient Vedic principle is being reenacted in the West. Even the government is giving raw foodstuffs to be transformed into spiritual foods for distribution. So ordinarily, when foodstuffs are distributed to the public, there's a benefit. Many people are hungry nowadays. But with spiritual food, the benefit is even greater, because Krishna actually manifests his spiritual energy in this foodstuff. So there's what you might call a hidden benefit, which we may not be able to fully understand, but nonetheless one that works very dramatically. An example of how this can be is when we take medicine, because we're not doctors or experts in medicine, don't understand exactly how these chemicals interact with the body and cure whatever ailment they cure. But nonetheless, we can feel the effects that they actually do something that cures the ailment. So similarly, spiritual food has a spiritual potency that acts in a similarly mysterious way. And the test of its working is something like the proof of the pudding is in the eating. You actually feel some spiritual benefit. So this is the hidden benefit. It's like God comes in disguise sometimes as an incarnation, a particular type, and this spiritual food also has a kind of benefit that's hidden, but nonetheless one that's very important. So for those of you who haven't gotten one yet, I just wanted to let you all know that we do have, for the first time, it's been many years coming, a little book just about this subject that I've been discussing. And half of it tells you very simply and very plainly how to prepare spiritual foodstuffs in your own home. We have a variety of different menus and some photographs of what it looks like after it's made in color. This book is called The Higher Taste, and it's available in the back table there. So if you don't have it already, pick it up, because you can really not only learn a lot about the practical aspects of preparing it yourself, but also there's some very interesting introductory matter about how this particular type of vegetarian diet, which is called lacto-vegetarian, can do you a lot of good, not only in terms of the nutrition and the physiological benefits, but also it's a way to save money. It's very practical in a lot of ways. And there's also some very interesting statistics here about how, on a global level, if the land masses that are used to raise animal food, cattle and so on, were used to raise food that would be directly fed to human beings, how we could immediately feed several hundreds of millions more people every day. So there's economic benefits. There's also a number of health benefits that are discussed in detail. So it's very interesting from the economic point of view, from the health point of view, from an ethical standpoint, and then, of course, from the spiritual standpoint, which you read about. So please pick one up if you don't have one. You'll find it very interesting, even if you don't use the menus, the recipes. So maybe someone has some questions. I just sort of skimmed over the surface of a very vast topic. And if you'd like to ask any questions, I'll try to answer them. Yes, ma'am. It depends to what extent you would like to involve yourself. Generally, what we recommend, this is explained in the book, that at least to make an offering of food in your home, we recommend that you just have a little photograph of a deity. Deity worship itself is something that's very, very complex to go into. And it involves a tremendous amount of knowledge of many minute and detailed procedures. Therefore, in a temple like this, there's only a few people who actually know everything, what to do, and participate in it fully. And even at that, we're still not following all the detailed instructions that are there in some of the Vedic books. In India, some of the procedures are extremely complicated. But the basic principle is that God can manifest himself in a form like this, or even in a photograph. And by having a little photograph of a deity, or of Krishna, as even a painting, one can develop one's spiritual consciousness, because he can manifest himself in that way. So it's a way of reminding us about God's presence. It is, actually, because chanting is the essence. If you want to go a little further, you can have a picture. But the most important thing is chanting. If you just hear the name, this is the recommended best method for realizing God, is to vibrate the sound and to hear the sound. And from that, everything else will automatically develop. So the first principle is, at least in this age, it's not the same in every age, and the best method for most people is to chant and concentrate your mind on the sound of the chanting. Then you get immediate spiritual benefit. Of course, it's not that you see a big white light and you suddenly fly over the mountains. It's gradual, but nonetheless, you can perceive it. Just like sometimes when you eat, it takes a little while to feel your hunger satisfied. But generally, we recommend if someone wants to try chanting, should try it for a week or two. Spend, say, 15 minutes to a half hour a day, and then you'll. It has to speak for itself. You know, it's something that has to be experienced. You can't know about it from just hearing me say about it. You have to experience it. So in that sense, it's kind of like eating. You can't get the experience of eating by watching someone else do it or to hear what it feels like. You have to do it yourself. So make a practical experiment if you're interested, and you'll see what spiritual consciousness is. Spiritual consciousness is something we don't experience in our ordinary lives. In the ordinary course of events, we never actually have any spiritual experiences. So when they're there, through the right process, we can have them and we can understand what they are. So we recommend that. And deity worship is something that's much more advanced if one wants to delve more deeply into the science. You have a question? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Everyone hear that question? He was asking, we had a few years ago, we published a book in which I did an interview with George Harrison about Krishna consciousness. And his question was, did he come to us because he was depressed? Is that your question? Or why did he? Anyway, the history of that is that he had been traveling around as a beetle and saw the devotees every once in a while through the car window on the street in New York and on the streets in London. And he kept seeing them over and over again. Sometimes it was very cold and rainy out in London. So he was very attracted by the idea that someone would be so dedicated. So he thought that in his mind someday he'd like to meet them, but he just never got around to it. So one day he just ran into some devotees and just sort of were in the same place, and he began to speak with them. And then he was very warm and happy to meet a devotee, and that led to him inviting the devotees to make a record in England, and gradually a relationship developed. So he started to chant and read the books and so on and so forth. There's a book, if anyone's interested, we have with this interview called Chant and Be Happy, in which this was last year we did the interview, in the year before last, in September. September of 82. So it's sort of like how he had evolved in Krishna consciousness up till then. It's very interesting, actually. And, you know, sort of goes back to the 60s, how he got involved and what it's done for him as a human being. So you get a little background. I would recommend you read that if you haven't. It's a question and answer. It's very easy to read. I go. Mm-hmm. Well, did everyone hear that? He asked about a rock record out that has the Hare Krishna chant on it. There's an LP. I don't know the name of the LP, but the singer's name is Nina Hagen, and she has a song where she chants. It's called "I Love Paul," and on the song, her singing chants. I think she is the singer, lead singer, chants the mantra about a dozen times. It's quite good, actually. How did I become a Hare Krishna? Well, I was introduced to our founder, Srila Prabhupada, in 1966. A friend took me to meet him. I heard him lecture. I bought some of his books. I started to read them. And a year later, I got more serious and decided to dedicate myself full time to it. But mainly, I liked the philosophy, and I was kind of always philosophically inclined. I liked to read philosophy, and I liked the books, and I felt that this was the most complete philosophy. So then gradually, I became more committed. No, not really. I'm from Portland, Oregon. My parents were Jewish. I lived in a Catholic neighborhood, and all my friends were Catholic. So I sort of like grew up a Judeo-Christian. But they weren't very religious, so it was kind of like just cultural tradition. At the back, you had a question? Changes in the movement? Well... it's gone to most countries in the world now. And when we first started, mostly young people joined. I would say the median age is something closer to 24 or 25 of the, maybe more than that, maybe 26 of the average member. So just the way you'd see any movement grow, I suppose you could say it's grown in terms of the numbers, the number of locations, restaurants, farm communities all over the world. Now there are a few dozen, probably about 40 restaurants now, and about 5 or 10 new ones opening every year. We've published a lot more books, probably distributed something in the realm of 200 or 300 million books. But I think what's probably unique about Krishna consciousness is that it's a cultural movement, and not just a religious, it's cultural and philosophical, not just a religious movement. So we see the growth of things like these paintings you see on the wall. We now have academies in America and Italy where colonies of artists concentrate full time on developing a whole new art form in terms of painting. And these paintings are being exhibited around the world. The painters are receiving acclaim. They're being published in books. They're being exhibited in galleries. They're in many countries. So they are actually developing a new, a very important art form. We're also opening, along those lines, multimedia shows, which use slideshows and movies and sound effects. We have one in Detroit and one in Los Angeles now, and we're about to open one in Australia and one in London, and a number of others. One's going to open in New York, I think, in about 2 months, in which things like our Bhagavad Gita, the book, is portrayed in a kind of audiovisual show. You walk through it, some of them you walk through, and you have diorama exhibits in 3D with back projections and stereophonic sound and so forth. So that explains the philosophy in a very easy to understand way. Instead of having to read a whole book, you can just see it and experience it. So those projects are now developing all over. We also have a television network, or I should say television production facility. We've produced about 100 television shows. One is a 13-part series that's airing all over the world. It's called Inside Hare Krishna. It's on the cable stations down here and all over the United States. We're expanding our festival programs more and more. These are also in the realm of what we call culture revolution, so to speak. In 1980, we were part of the Indo-English Festival of India, which was sponsored by both governments. And our Rath Yatra Festival, which is a big, what we call chariot festival, went through the streets of London. And then we had a number of exhibits of sculpture and art along with this. So, but these festivals are very much cultural festivals in which we exhibit the foodstuffs, the painting, the sculpture, the drama, what our schooling system is like, our ideas about vegetarianism and reincarnation, books, and lifestyle, and many, many other things. In the United States this year, we'll have about 30 of these festivals from June till, actually they'll probably start in May, from May through the end of October. And of course, in almost every other major country of the world, we have some form of this Rath Yatra festival. Our congregation has grown very big now. We have, throughout the world, millions of followers in terms of our congregation. And anyway, that's it in some. It's a very broad question. Yeah.
You see the Hare Krishna movement continuing to westernize?
It's not really westernizing. Once Prabhupada was told, our founder, when he was about to come to America, one of his colleagues told him, when you go to the West, you're going to have to learn how to eat with a fork and knife. And he said, when I go to the West, I'm going to teach them how to eat with their hands. So actually, that's the way we, as devotees, we all, for years and years, we, you know, completely adopted the Indian style of life. So really, rather than westernize, it's a combination of West and East. It's not becoming Western, rather it's synthesizing East and West. The principle is one that's used with this metaphor. There's a lame man, but he has very good vision. There's a blind man, but he's very strong. So the West is symbolized by this blind man, but who's physically very strong. And the Indian culture, at least the Indian Vedic culture, is symbolized by the person who is lame but has very sharp vision. So the West is very full of resources, very wealthy, but its vision is very, spiritual vision is very meager. It's not very spiritually oriented. Whereas in the East, you have a great spiritual culture over thousands of years, but materially they're not very well off. So the idea is the two should combine, such that if this lame man climbs on the shoulders of the blind man, who's very strong, and tells him, go this way and go that way, then the whole thing works very nicely. He can guide the strong man who's blind, and they can go everywhere they need to go. So the idea is that if the materially resourceful West and the spiritually visionary East combine together, then they can do a great service for the whole world. So in planting the Eastern culture of Krishna consciousness in the West, it's a kind of bhakti yoga where the resources of the West, they can be used to actually, just like I was talking about television, they can actually transform society. Television generally has a certain debilitating effect, you know, at least there's studies that it hurts the eyes and children become violent by watching it. There's a report by the National Institute of Mental Health that said it makes people violent. You know, very scientific, 10-year study with, you know, hundreds of different locations and so on. So if you take television and broadcast spiritual subject matter over it, the association, the power of this medium is so great that you can actually do a very great good for society by implanting higher ideals. So it's a certain responsibility to use that which is very good in such a way that it can actually reach people. Because formerly, all of this knowledge was kind of kept in the caves of the wise men, so to speak. But in the late 20th century, in the late 19th century, there was a great visionary who saw that this spiritual consciousness would begin to come out of India and enter into the West. So as a matter of just being practical, all of the technology that's available in the West can be used for a higher purpose. It's like sometimes people think that a religion shouldn't have money, so to speak. I mean, it's a general kind of idea. Maybe it's because Christ walked barefoot and so on. But actually, if you think about it carefully, money in itself isn't really good or bad. It can be used for good things or for bad things. It can build bombs or hospitals. So similarly, if one is practical, one can utilize everything in the material world and use it for a good purpose. This is called bhakti yoga, actually. The science that we practice is the science of transforming that which is material into that which is spiritual. That's really what this whole movement is all about. And this is done by the synthesis of East and West. This is called bhakti yoga, to bring everything into devotion, into what is called spirit or spiritual consciousness. So even a material object, even it becomes somewhat transformed when we're speaking spiritual subject matters. Even the company that makes it gets a certain karmic benefit when it's used for a spiritual purpose. Is that too far out? Because that which is unknown is that which is feared, or tends to be feared. So if you can come down and eat and enjoy, then it's more palatable. You're more familiar. So naturally, to be practical is to demonstrate how actually what we're talking about here, what we're practicing, is not really foreign. It may look foreign, but by nature, we're a part of God. We're actually constitutionally part of God, but we have no experience of it. We're here to enjoy. I mean, that's the basic principle of life. It's to enjoy. But nonetheless, our enjoyment has its limitations. Some of the greatest forms of enjoyment are followed by big bouts of depression or disease or so on. That's the way it is. If you enjoy drinking a lot, you're going to have a reaction. Whatever, anything to excess, any form of enjoyment generally has a reaction. So when we talk about a form of enjoyment that doesn't have a reaction, it's so natural that you just never have, there's not a coming down point. It just stays at a certain level. Generally, people, they can't believe it because we have no experience of that kind of feeling. The pleasure-pain principle is that you feel pleasure and then you have to have pain afterwards. That's a kind of a psychological principle that Freud posited, the whole idea. There's no such thing as pleasure unless you have pain, and vice versa. You don't know what pleasure is until you feel pain. You don't know what pain is until you have pleasure. So spiritual pleasure is different. You don't have these ups and downs. But in order to, because it sounds like it's not possible to have that, Krishna consciousness has to be made very familiar. You know, it has to be as simple as eating, as natural as eating. So therefore we have things like this so people can see that actually it's not something that's beyond our reach or beyond our understanding. It's very natural. This is actually what is most natural, to have a relationship with God, because this is the essence of enjoyment. God is enjoyment personified. But how to get to that? So little by little. They say that spiritual knowledge is poison in the beginning and nectar in the end. And material enjoyment is poison is nectar in the beginning and poison in the end, as I was saying before. So to learn anything or to do anything substantial, we all know it takes effort. To be an athlete, you really got to work out. You got to strain. But then it comes a point when it gets easy and it becomes fun. So spiritual consciousness is also like that. It's not easy in the beginning. It's not easy even to understand. But in the end, you can see by the devotees, they're very happy. And it does become easy. So for a teacher to teach something, he must make the subject very familiar, very, as you say, palatable. That's the art of a teacher. He makes something that kids don't want to learn mathematics, but he makes it very palatable. He tells nice stories about it, or he makes nice pictures, has nice examples. He uses apples to add up the numbers instead of ones in the blackboard. So naturally, this is the process of teaching. You have to make things palatable. I think I don't want to leave anybody out. Oh, maybe he decided to pass. Go ahead. The distinction is generally a rather technical one, because this is out of the broad Hindu tradition, which is based on the same book, Bhagavad Gita, which is followed by all the Hindus, 650 million or so. Krishna is the main speaker in Bhagavad Gita. Mainly, Krishna consciousness is personalism. Krishna is the supreme being. And Krishna is worshipped primarily in his personal form, as God with a form. And Hinduism per se has many different ways to worship Krishna, not always in the personal form, sometimes in the impersonal form. So this is a little bit of a distinction, but generally it's out of the same tradition. The word Hindu, to be very technical, is not really a Sanskrit word. It comes out of the Indus River Valley. Originally, I think it's Macedonian, and then the pronunciation was changed, and it became the word Hindu. It actually referred to that area, which became Hindustan, now India. But generally, it's based on the same principles. Yes?
Could you tell us a little bit about worship
Well, Lord Chaitanya is kind of the basis of the Hare Krishna movement because he revived Vaishnavism or personalism. He actually revived the principle of bhakti yoga and chanting the mantra 500 years ago. So he's very important, a very, very important figure on the historical scene, even for Hinduism per se, because it was a tremendous revival, and in one sense it was Hare Krishna. Lord Chaitanya's movement is the Hare Krishna movement. He admitted anyone and everyone into the fold of Krishna consciousness, because at that time India was being ruled by the Mohammedans. There was a certain, although it, nothing like it developed into, there was a certain conflict. But Lord Chaitanya was very extraordinary in that he was able to surmount not only the conflict between Hindu and Muslim, but also even within Hinduism, there was a very rigid system of caste at that time based on birth. And he was a great pioneer in the sense that he not only admitted from any caste, Gandhi later became famous for his dealing with the so-called Harijans as being equal to everyone, the outcast, but even admitted Mohammedans into his order. In fact, some of the greatest Vaishnavas in the time of Lord Chaitanya were from Mohammedan families. So he was kind of a revolutionary, really, in that sense, historically. Not only that he revived the basic principles of Vaishnavism, personalism, but also that he had very broad social. There was a very broad social impact to what he did, which still is existing today. You wanted to ask something? Right. Right. Chandalas, Yavanas, in fact, in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, you'll find statements about how these can even come to the point of being the spiritual master or the guru. And oh yes, he's considered a full manifestation of God, Lord Chaitanya, definitely. There are 8 shlokas which he left. He spoke. All the other literature concerning Lord Chaitanya is written by his close followers and his contemporaries. Some were a little after him, but there's a big set, 17-volume set of hardback books. If you're interested, it's each one's about 400 pages long. It's a complete biography of Lord Chaitanya with photographs of his temples that are still there in India, the place where he was born, and so on, and also paintings. Taken from various writings about him and his life. Oh yes! In fact, last month, the government established a committee to honor the fifth centenary, or the 500th appearance anniversary of Lord Chaitanya. And the Prime Minister garlanded his picture and made a speech in a big auditorium in New Delhi about Lord Chaitanya. She said that, Indira Gandhi, that Lord Chaitanya is a symbol of bhakti, and that through bhakti we can improve all of our, if our ordinary mundane works within the material world are suffused with bhakti, then all the problems of life can be solved. So Lord Chaitanya is very well known. They're printing a stamp with his picture this year, and he's very widely No, especially in eastern India, in Bengal. You will find almost every Hindu family has a picture of Lord Chaitanya somewhere in the house. So, I would suggest you read some of those. Maybe just get the first book and you'll find it very, very interesting. If you want to find out more. And then as far as Prabhupada, I had some close relationship with him in his early days in New York, in which I tried to help get the mission established and so on. And through his grace, I was able to take up the practice and become saved from the pangs of material life. You had a question a long time ago, about 10 minutes ago. I didn't call on you. For the which future? For the future. Plans for the future? Yeah. Well, one thing that you have to understand is that something, a spiritual movement, or is in one sense, just like even with Christianity, we saw endured through many, many years of Allah. I mean, there were tremendous strife. People were being slaughtered and crucified and so on, fed to the lions. But a real spiritual process will endure, Hare Krishna. If it's a genuine process, it will endure all material changes, because it's very, very deeply rooted in the, as I was saying before, in the very essence of life itself. And really, the thing that we're all after is happiness. And actually, when you think about it, when all of our material enjoyments are stripped away, which is what happens at the time of death, then people begin to get this sense of spiritual something, God enjoying something spiritual. Unfortunately, that's the way it is, that people don't think too much about spiritual matters or God until there's a major crisis at the doorstep, sort of thing. Like during the war, everyone goes and prays in the church that their husband or their son comes back, and ordinarily they would never go. This is due to what we call the fever of material life. The higher the fever, so to speak, of material life, the more difficult it is to know what the cure is or to accept it. It's like as someone who's delirious with fever, he doesn't want to take medicine because he's not in his proper frame of mind. So, actually, Lord Chaitanya prophesied that Krishna consciousness would be manifest in every town and village of the world. And, of course, he's an incarnation of God. We accept his prophecy. But beyond that, we can reason that something that is truly spiritual, that is above the rules, so to speak, of the material energy, of the material nature, will endure, even in the midst of, or even after, great devastation. Everything that we experience happens under laws, just like there's the law of gravity. It's acting on us right now. We don't feel it necessarily, but when we try to jump, do the high jump or something like that, we become very aware. We try to shoot a rocket out into space. It's a big, costs a lot of money to overcome this law of gravity. So similarly, there's other laws that are acting, more subtle laws. There's the law of karma, for example. And there's all sorts of material energies that are acting on us. The Gita calls these the modes of nature, the three modes of nature. And they're explained in different ways. But spiritual consciousness is actually something that takes place beyond the realm of these material laws. In the material world, we're subject to birth and death and disease and old age. And spiritual consciousness, Krishna consciousness, is a science for overcoming even death. So this is something that's very deep. It's not easy to understand how you can overcome death, but it all stems from the concept of the soul, which is a spiritual entity. It's the real self within the true self, and it actually survives the death experience. It doesn't become wet. It's not material. It's an anti-material substance. So this is the first principle of spiritual life, to understand that we can't actually be destroyed. So this is the first teaching of Bhagavad Gita. This is the book that Mahatma Gandhi read every day of his life. He studied this book. Of course, they didn't show that in the movie, unfortunately, but it's very satisfying because it actually explains that we are not material. At essence, we're a spiritual being. We can enjoy spiritually, and the soul can never be hurt by weapons. It can never be cut into pieces. It can never be burned by fire. These are some of the ways the soul is described in the Gita. It's not material. So when we begin to understand this, and that we are non-material beings at essence, and that we actually survive, then we can see how a movement that's based on this principle is not going to be destroyed by an atomic bomb, which will destroy everything material that it's close enough to. But it can't actually destroy something that's not material, antimatter. The soul is so subtle that it cannot be actually destroyed. It's the eternal principle of life. Way you can develop spiritual consciousness. So machines, tractors, airplanes, cars, microphones, tape recorders, typewriters, computers, they can actually be used to spread Krishna consciousness. And people depend on those things right now. But we don't depend on them. If they're there, they're not there. If they're there, we're going to use them. If they're not there, we don't have to use them. We never used them before. They were never used to spread Krishna consciousness before. They're here. They can be used. And then when they're not here, we don't have to have them. So the point is that from the material point of view, people depend on these things. They have to have them. But from the spiritual point of view, our point of view, we don't have to have them. If they're there, we'll use them. If they're not there, we won't use them. So the point is that the future, maybe there won't be machines, or many of machines. Maybe that there will be some drastic changes in the way society looks. But nonetheless, Krishna consciousness will go on. I mean, probably our society will become much more agrarian and rural again. It's many futurists predict this. And certainly if there's big wars and so on, it's very natural to think that life is going to assume a more rural and agrarian aspect, more natural way. It's only after all been a couple of hundred years that things have begun to be industrialized. So we have our rural communities, and there's definitely plans for continuing along those lines. That's right. That's a fact. You had a question?
It's funny that they didn't show Gandhi reading the Bhagavad Gita in the movie.
Yeah. Sure, because they're both, you know, somewhat recent. I mean, compared to, you know, going back beyond 2,000 years, and both reformers. In fact, you see, if you look at their pictures, sometimes you see a lot of similarity. Point is that God has many different incarnations and forms, and His great representatives like these, they come with a purpose in mind. So their qualities are so extraordinary that their contemporaries immediately sense that there's something very great, wonderful. They have certain qualities there. They have humility, they have gravity, they have knowledge, they have compassion, they have great magnetism, and all these things combined. There are actually 28 qualifications of a devotee that are described in one of our books, The Nectar of Devotion. And when you see these, you see that in all great representatives of the Lord, you'll find all these qualities. So they are similar. They're godly or saintly. So the principle is called sadhu sangha in Sanskrit, that one should associate with those who are saintly, and then saintly qualities will be transferred by the power of association. So this is the real important thing in life, to have good association. It's like I was saying before, if you watch television a lot, it's bad association. People go out and kill because they saw somebody do it, and they go out, and sometimes little kids or young people, they'll go out and do the same thing they saw on television. It's just because they've seen it. And similarly, they say man's known by the company he keeps. So this is a fact, that association is very, very critical. There's a story in one of our books about a young, very young boy who was raised. He was very sober and very gentle by nature. He happened to see a couple in a sexual embrace, just a chance occurrence. And the woman was a prostitute. Anyway, just on his mind, just stayed in his mind, because he was young and he was naturally very impressionable. Anyway, the whole story is long, but he ends up getting married to this prostitute later on. And in order to do it, he left his wife. He had a very beautiful wife, but somehow he was attracted to this woman. And he just lived with her up till he was 88 years old. And he became a very hardened criminal. And this is just an example that's given. It's in the Srimad Bhagavatam. Of course, in the end, he kind of came to his senses. But association is the point. Just from this one little glance, this chance occurrence, he wasn't able to even keep a normal marriage. So by the same token, if one has association with saintly people, even a very brief moment, it's described in this book about Lord Chaitanya, just a moment's association, one can develop perfection of life. So it's important to pick good company. And therefore, we try to form an association where people can have access to good association. Yes? We have schools that our children go to, and sometimes people who aren't devotees send their children to our schools. So they have their own curriculums. Our school in England just got certification by the government, which covers the whole country. So they're actually quite good, even from the academic point of view. They're doing very well. So that's a very important point. Naturally, it's one of the major things that our society is working on, developing the curriculum now beyond the 12th grade level. Because our movement is a little young, so the high school curriculum is still being developed also. There's emphasis, the primary emphasis is on developing the qualities of a devotee and developing the spiritual side of life. I mean, all the academics are there, but the main principle is to become a teacher of Krishna consciousness and an example for society. So even though they specialize in a lot of fields, even like some are going to have computer training and so on, the principle is to develop character, very high character. Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, generally, we're trying to stop using all machines on the farms, on our farms. But we don't want to have to be dependent on them. And also, we want all the people that live there to have work. And the machines take their work away. So the machines are only being used temporarily until we can get away from them and just use animals. Yeah, in the beginning it is. That's why we use the machines. Well, if you actually analyze the whole situation right now, you'll see that because people are using all these machines to become more efficient, the whole situation has become less efficient because the cost of buying food is higher, ultimately, and more people are out of work. I mean, 35,000 farms a year go out of business in the United States because agribusiness is buying them all up with their big machines, and they're out of work. But, you know, if you don't have the machines, everyone's working. So it's not economic sense that someone who even lives out in the country has to buy all his vegetables from a store. Some of them come from far away. So what we're trying to get back to is the agrarian principle, where you know you don't have to depend on shipping and packaging and big machines, because they're they're actually causing a lot of people to go hungry. I mean, if you actually see how the whole thing is working now. When you buy something in a store, half of it you're paying for the package. And the advertising that went into, you know, sometimes two-thirds of the price is for that. And, you know, the whole thing is so messed up now that the government is paying people to not grow on their land. And there's such a huge stock of dairy products now because Ronald Reagan, when he was running for office, you know, wanted the votes of the dairy people. So they spent $2 billion, the government, buying dairy products last year so that the dairy farmers' prices would be huge, would be so high that now people are paying almost 7 cents more for a gallon of milk than they would ordinarily have to pay, artificially inflated. Anyway, so we're getting the surplus food and distributing it to the poor. But that's the situation. And if actually it's in the beginning wasn't so bad, but now that all the farms are controlled by machines, they've made the whole situation very desperate in terms of unemployment. It's happening not only in this country but in Europe also, the same thing. Yeah. Yeah. Well, this is the problem. The basic problem is that people think that they own everything, and that they should control everything, whereas the spiritual life is that God owns everything. So the secret to becoming peaceful is to know that, and then people won't be so selfish and exploitative. The real problem is that the rich are exploiting the poor, and in these so-called third world countries, you know, these big companies go and they buy the land and they grow tobacco and they export it. And the people who live around there, they can't even get a decent meal. I mean, this is, you know, going over billions and billions of square miles of land all over the world. That's what's happening. And that's why people are hungry, basically, because of exploitation. So the principle is to change their consciousness, that not everything gravitates around me, and I have to build up my empire and exploit as many people as possible. But, you know, he has to have a sense that there's a world community and that we all have some common fraternity. And that's by knowing God as the Father, and everyone is a brother. And then, you know, this might makes right philosophy begins to retreat into the background. But unless you have spiritual consciousness, you can speak about peace and friendship and brotherhood and all that. But unless you actually have something concrete to base it on, it's just empty words going out into the ether. Nice speeches on Christmas Eve and New Year's Day, but the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. That's unfortunate, but that's what's happening. Yes?
Oh, yeah.
Well, they're not so much concerned about us using a surplus food. They're happy to give that to us because they can't even distribute it because the states are so poor. You mean like on the farms?
Yeah, on the farm. Yeah, labor.
Basically, yeah. The government is trying to tax all religions. The internal, what's it called? IRS, Internal Revenue Service. They're definitely trying to move in and get as much money as they can out of all the religions because they're seeing billions of dollars being poured into religious movements from donations. You know, there's the big evangelists and so many. And they want to get their hands on it, obviously. I mean, they're not even trying to hide it. They're definitely doing it. They've made several attempts in different places to, you know, increase this tax, that tax, and, you know, find some way to get their hands on the money. So, you know, we're sort of in the era of Caesar instead of God type of thing. You know, the government is more and more taxing religions. Well, they're making their inroads. I mean, the drift of things is that they're getting a little more. They're working day and night, scheming ways to, you know, make some new rulings and get a little more here and there. But of course, we don't lose sleep over it because, like I said before, we don't depend on material things. If there's no money, we'll still go on. But it's definitely a question of sort of Caesar versus God, as some of them say. The nature is that man wants to control, and because generally, governments tend to be, at least in practice, maybe not in theory, atheistic. They don't really care that much if their religions or not. If they can get more tax money, that's their job. But in prior eras, when the society wasn't quite so contaminated, there was, and still in many parts of the world, government is much more respectable and doesn't try to tax religions. But basically, the governments are atheistic by nature. And therefore, the whole world is in a very chaotic state. Yes?
The goal of being a Christian devotee is to die and enter a Christian spiritual realm, a Christian spiritual realm. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
What's the relationship between that and a Christian? And I'm sure Christians would be kind of terrible with another being in Jesus Christ.
Yeah, well, there's two ways to answer that question. One is that while, and this is the esoteric one, there is a spiritual world which is not affected by material energy or material laws. So we talk about spirit, like I was saying before, there's an atma or a soul, a spiritual energy, something that you can't see but nonetheless very powerful. When we talk about the spiritual world, which is where a pure devotee is transferred, where the soul goes after the demise of the body at a certain period, we're also talking about something that's very difficult to understand. Just to understand the soul is very difficult, that it's anti-material, that it can't be cut, dried, can't be hurt, can't be touched, can't be seen because it's so minute. You have to understand what that is first. It's just something like, maybe you can understand it a little in terms of what we think of when we talk about atomic energy. We know that it's something you can't see, but it's so powerful. It can blow up a whole city, or it can heat a whole city. It can do good or bad, but it's very powerful, but it's subtle. Or, you know, what do they call the fallout, whatever that is, fission, fusion. It's all very subtle. It's happening down in the molecules and the atoms. No one's ever even seen it, but we know it's there, and we know it's very powerful. So even more subtle than this energy is spiritual energy. It's actually much more powerful also. That's why this atomic energy, it can't even touch the soul. It can harm the body, but it can't even begin to touch the soul, because the soul is so fine and so subtle that it can't be touched by even the atomic energy. So that's giving a little idea what the soul is. That's what this whole Krishna consciousness science is about, how to perceive that soul and begin to act in such a way so that the soul is directing the activity of the body and the mind. Now that takes a lot of time and practice to understand. So when we talk about the spiritual world, that's also made of spirit. It's made of the same thing that the soul is. And there's very elaborate descriptions of the spiritual world. And we can describe them. We have many beautiful pictures of what the spiritual world looks like. So even though you can understand what it's like by hearing these descriptions by pure devotees and by the Vedas, you may not fully understand it. But nonetheless, there is a spiritual world. And the spiritual world is a place where the body does not deteriorate. It's always full of bliss. It doesn't have to sleep. It's not a gross body with flesh and blood. It has the same form as ours, the same shape, but it's not made of matter. And the enjoyment is very, very subtle. It's there, and it's very intense, but it's based on devotion. Krishna is there. There are devotees constantly singing and dancing. It's said in the spiritual world that every word is a song, every step is a dance. Anyway, there's whole volumes of books about what the spiritual world is like, what the beings there are like, what the land is like, what the feelings are like. Very, very elaborate. I won't have time to go into it, but there's one book called Krishna Book, which describes this. It's from the 10th canon of the Srimad Bhagavatam. So that's called the spiritual world. And rather than give you a comparative study of what that is compared to the Christian heaven, I would just direct you to read a little about the spiritual world and then read what you can find in Christian literature about what heaven is really like. And I think, just to make it very brief, I think you'll find that there's a very dramatic difference. At least you'll know a lot more about the spiritual world than you'll know about heaven by reading it. You know, I won't go into a lot more detail, but, you know, it's a thing you have to kind of get into. And then the second part of that, of my answer to your question is this the goal of a Krishna devotee to go to heaven? This is what a devotee aspires to, but at the same time, a devotee feels that he's an appointee, so to speak, of Krishna, and that his main business is to alleviate the problem of the material world by giving some sense of spiritual bliss, Krishna consciousness. So he's willing never to go back to the spiritual world, if that's the Lord's will, as long as he can be engaged in the service of Krishna by preaching, so to speak, by trying to infuse Krishna consciousness and alleviate the suffering of the material condition of life and associate with devotees. Excuse me. So, in one sense, this is the primary ambition of a devotee. If he does get to go back to the spiritual world, then that's very nice. But if he doesn't, then he's very satisfied just to stay in the material world as long as he can be engaged in Krishna's service, in the service of the Lord. Of course, anyone who does that will be promoted. But sometimes devotees are actually sent, even from the spiritual world, to go and canvass and preach on Krishna's behalf. Those blissful experiences. In other words, you have to see what they are. If it works, if it's actually something that gives you some benefit, then it's worthwhile. In our case, it's chanting. And as I said, you have to see You have to try it, because you can't just hear what it is anymore. You can hear what eating is like. Of course, there's a very great philosophy, many, many books to read, and if you really want to understand things fully, you would want to read and understand all about transmigration of the soul, about the nature of energy, time, matter. And therefore, if someone is inquisitive or a little philosophical, then he find, like in my case, I found reading the books was very satisfying for me. So that's a major emphasis. But unless you have the spiritual experience, unless you perform the process to actually break into the anti-material world, which we don't experience, then it remains a mystery. So you have to have some experience like that in order to enter into this realm of understanding. Nobody is able to learn anything about anything unless you have some experience of it. And you can't have an experience unless you go through certain, you have to take steps to have that experience. It doesn't just come by someone talking to you. You have to take certain steps. Yes?
Can you tell me who wrote the Vedas?
Vyasadev. He's the person who wrote them.
I was told they were written by God.
They were spoken by God, and they were recorded, written by Vyasadev. He's the author. Yes. Yeah. Well, we have to understand first that God loves us. It's not a one-way thing. And when we understand the intensity of God's love for us, then we feel a little more inclined. So the first one has to understand that it's there. And God is very affectionate to living beings, especially when they express some devotion. So when one begins to feel some reciprocation, then it's so satisfying that it becomes easy. The fact is that God isn't actually that far away. He's actually in the heart as the supersoul. But because we are far away by our desire to enjoy in the material world, we have so many forms of enjoyment that we make God seem far away. But actually, He's always with us, waiting for us to turn to Him as a super soul. There's a verse in Bhagavad Gita that explains yayatamam prapadyante, that exactly our degree of surrender is how much Krishna reciprocates His love. So again, by associating with those who are immersed in this loving feeling of devotion, you immediately get the sense of God's love, because you see it being reciprocated in somebody else. So that brings God very close. That's a shortcut, so to speak. It's the principle of association. You can actually see that it's real through people who are receiving it. It doesn't seem so different. But people that try to go out into a forest and meditate and absorb love of God, they just don't succeed.
Job, people are definitely truly devoted. It seems like the greatest job
Yeah, because we're all part of God. We're all related to God. So one who loves God, that person will love the whole universe. He'll not only love human beings, but he'll love animals. He won't even want to step on an ant. That's a true lover of God. So, as I was saying before, this idea of brotherhood, it only becomes possible when one loves God. Otherwise, there's talk of brotherhood, but it's just like the United Nations. There's so much talk of supposed to be, you know, the fighting settlement arena sort of thing, but they're always fighting in the arena. No, they're not. So, but because there's no spiritual principle, that's why that's happening. There's no God in the United Nations. It's a secular institution. You know, because they removed God, then the whole concept of brotherhood has actually just become a vain platitude. It doesn't really exist. I mean, it exists, but only in theory, and rarely in practice. So God has to become the Ishvarasya, the center of society. And the whole society immediately becomes peaceful. In fact, when Srila Prabhupada first came to America, we had a little peace vigil in front of the United Nations. We had a little pamphlet we distributed called the Peace Formula. And it's based on this one verse in the Bhagavad Gita, which says that God is the supreme controller and the supreme being, the supreme friend, the supreme enjoyer, and the supreme controller. And that when one understands this, then immediately he becomes peaceful. And then, you know, nations aren't fighting with one another because they see the land as all belonging to God. And these borders are actually artificial. Just created, and then they have a big war over two pieces of land that they don't even own anyway. They just use for a little while, and then they're finished. Everybody, all the people die. So this idea of becoming attached to nationalism is a result of godlessness. You're right, and people have to become more God conscious. Then the solution to all the world's problems is not so far away. But according to the Srimad Bhagavatam, if you try to solve a material problem with another material solution, then you create another material problem. This is called Maya Sukhaya. Just like when people invented cars because they didn't think they could get from A to B fast enough, then they found out they had to get a lot more money so they could build roads. And then the more roads they built, the more accidents there were. And also more pollution. And then there's the whole, you know, I forgot what it is. So many people die every minute on the every hour on the road. There's a large number of... So, there has to be a spiritual solution. Otherwise, you know, there's just one problem after the other. You have atomic power. They have this place up here, San Onofre, and everyone's picketing. One breaks down and then all the energy is released. So many people die. So there has to be a practical solution to all this. And this is possible with Krishna consciousness. I'm going way over time, Vadriya. So maybe we have one more question. Everybody got spent out. Okay, last one. God can be pretty scary, you know, sitting up there in the clouds throwing thunderbolts down. No, I think really seriously, people are frightened of that which they don't know, which they're not aware of. Quite a simple. Also, some people may be afraid that because this is a different value system. Some people, that's not the main reason. The main reason is people don't know. And we're afraid of what we don't know. People are afraid of death because they don't know what happens. Well, our philosophy is not to give it up, but to just like Jesus Christ said, be in the world, but not of the world. We're spirits in the material world. We're actually spiritual. And we don't have to give it up. We have to live in it nicely and use it nicely, and the whole world will be influenced for the better. Are you a student? Anyway, if you associate with devotees, you'll find that your life becomes very peaceful. And things become very clear. Actually, the world appears very chaotic and complicated. But spiritual consciousness is a way to actually penetrate. Just like, you know, when you're young, you sometimes, as you grow older, you begin to understand things a little better, things that were baffling and mysterious to you. In Krishna consciousness, we can see in such a way that things become more clear, because many of us don't want to admit it, but we actually find a lot of the things that we experience to be very baffling, because it's very difficult to understand material energy. So therefore one becomes peaceful. A spiritual knowledge enables us to even better understand the psychology of people, which is very difficult to understand. Very, very difficult. So, while we're not trying to teach people to become better materialists, at the same time, your material life does become better when you become spiritually strong. We have many members of our congregation who will attest that so many things that improved for them when they became involved with Krishna consciousness in their personal life, their business, and so on. Because the mind becomes clear. So I think we're going to chant a little. Anyway, keep coming and chant. We have also, you can get chanting beads if you want. You can take them home and try them out. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.